Sorry, not your fault. They were stationed at Pendleton together. Then he transferred to 3rd Meph. He pronounced it Meph. In Okinawa. Margaret requested a transfer, but then Columbus Day happened and, you know, air transport was limited, the internet went down and then wasn't reliable. They both shipped out to Paradise, but on separate ships. When they landed, they kept in touch by Z-phone. Would telling you about their conversations be an invasion of their privacy? Damn it. Yes. Me even asking about their personal conversations would be an abuse of power, so don't do it. Could I tell you that while he was stuck on Okinawa after Columbus Day, Sergeant Green had a relationship with a civilian? That bastard. I glared at the guy, feeling bad for Margaret. Hey, Adams hasn't been exactly celibate, you know. She requested a transfer to Okinawa, but I can tell you she had second thoughts about it. Was she having second thoughts about him? Answering that question may run into a privacy issue. Then don't answer. I sighed. My life sucks. Joe, they haven't seen each other in a long time. He thought she was dead. Margaret did go visit his parents in El Paso once after we returned from Newark. Would it violate her privacy to say that she has not mentioned Lamar Green more than a half dozen times since I've known her? You already mentioned it, so privacy is kind of moot. What I'm trying to say is Margaret has not been pining away for him. She hasn't seen him in a long time. It's natural they are happy to meet again. Part of me wanted to go break up the party. They were no longer hugging, but they were standing very close and talking softly. He touched the name tag on her chest, and his hand lingered there. She wasn't objecting. My intervention wasn't necessary, and wouldn't have been appropriate anyway. Fabrone called Green into formation. The commando team was lining up in front of the dodo. And right then, the Ruhar Observer came out of the dropship making demands, and I had to deal with that right away. Plus, I knew there was a Girapta we hadn't counted on, and a whole host of other issues that occupied my time and attention. Chapter 30. That was a rough day for me, and I'm not even talking about the wonderful news I got about Lamar freaking Green. The Ruha we captured was a class-to-rank officer named Kata Rabinon. She was outraged, and rightfully so. I told her she was right to be outraged, and I listened to her complaints. And I explained that we needed the commando team to prevent a dire threat to Paradise, to the entire concept of the Alien Legion. It was just my luck that Clasta Rabinon was a barracks lawyer. She railed at me, citing interstellar law that I wasn't familiar with and didn't care about. She told me I was stupid, that I was crazy for kidnapping a Ruhar soldier. Damn, when she got wound up, there was no stopping her. Humans needed the Ruhar to protect them in the cold, harsh universe. The threat to Paradise was a threat only to the humans on Paradise, so it was our problem. She didn't even like the Alien Legion. She thought the whole idea of allowing primitive alien humans to fight was a distraction, and that giving weapons to the Verdkris was pure insanity. She... Well, blah blah blah, you get the idea. No way was she ever going to cooperate. Reluctantly, I ordered Kapoor to have two of his people escort our guest to her new quarters. The cabin we locked her in was larger than usual, though I don't think she noticed, or cared. Maybe after a couple weeks she would calm down. I wasn't counting on it. She was a prisoner of war, and sugarcoating it wouldn't change the reality of the situation. Of the 18 humans we took from the dodo, 12 were immediately enthusiastic about joining the merry band of pirates. They heard going home, and were all in. None of the 12 had significant long-term ties to Paradise and were eager to see their friends and family on Earth. 4 others had mixed feelings about being shanghaied. They figured there was more to the story than what we initially told them and didn't believe that humans had been flying around the galaxy causing havoc on our own. The remaining 2 were very much not happy about essentially being kidnapped. Both were guys on the French team. One of them had a girlfriend on Paradise. The other guy had married a woman on Paradise, and she was due to have their baby in 2 months. I truly felt sorry for that guy, and nothing I said could console him. "You are taking me away from my wife and child!" he glared at me. Before I could respond, Commandant Fabrone intervened. "Gaston." He used the guy's first name to establish rapport. Colonel Bishop is not taking you away from your family. The war is taking you away. You could have been killed out here or on any nameless planet we do not know or care about. If this mission fails, the Taranin will deliver a bioweapon to Paradise and kill everyone, including Catherine and your son. Gaston was no longer shooting daggers at me with his eyes. He also was not happy. My son will grow up without me, never knowing me. That's not completely true, I said without thinking. Shit. So far, we had told only the good news to the Paradise people. They didn't know that Earth was inevitably doomed, that our best hope was to pull thousands of people to safety and abandon billions to a terrible fate. We were giving info a little bit at a time, in bite-sized chunks, to avoid overwhelming them. Like, we had told them that we had help from an advanced AI, but we hadn't told them the nature of that AI, and Skippy had not spoken to them yet. Listen, I checked Gaston's name tag because I wasn't going to use his first name. He wore three stripes. That was a staff sergeant in the U.S. Army, but I couldn't remember the equivalent rank in French terms. NATO code OR6. That was, Sergeant Chef Pashal. Our best estimate is that within 2 years, the secret of humans flying around the galaxy will be exposed. They might be able to guess that was bad news for Earth. I would let them reach that conclusion on their own. At that point, you can go back to Paradise. If that's possible, you understand? I can't make any promises. A lot can happen in 2 years. A single day can be fateful, Fabron muttered. Sorry about today, I said truthfully. It wasn't by choice. Fabron raised an eyebrow. Colonel, I meant Columbus Day. Oh, yeah, of course. Pashal, Commandant Fabron spoke the truth. If we don't stop the Theranin, every human on Paradise is at risk. Pashal stiffened. He looked to Fabron and nodded with a gesture so curt it was almost imperceptible. Colonel Bishop, you will take the fight to the Theranin? I knew what he meant. He wanted to hit the aliens who were threatening his family. We are taking the fight to any aliens who need to get their asses kicked. There are a lot of them, and we can't do it alone, Sergeant Chef. Are you with us? His answer was to click his boot heels together and snap a salute to me. I would like to kick some ass, sir. In his French accent, what he said was almost funny, but there was nothing humorous about the determined expression he wore. Polish up your ass-kicking boots, Pashal, I told him. It's a target-rich environment out there. The Ruha liaison officer was never going to cooperate with us. She was a prisoner of war, and all we could do was treat her as well as we could and wait until we could send her back to her people. We couldn't do that until it no longer mattered that aliens knew humans were flying starships, so she was going to be waiting a long time. I mean, hopefully we could keep our secret for another year or two. The commando team was either pumped up about joining us, or at least willing to do their duty. That was until they learned the full truth. That night at dinner, I planned to give them a briefing on the strategic situation, and to introduce them to both Nagatha and Skippy. It was best they learned the unvarnished truth now, rather than in the middle of the rescue operation. I needed them to be focused and fully committed. If any of them was going to bail out, it was best to get that over with before we invested a lot of time and effort in training them up for the op. The Gerapatha was a totally different story. He was a beetle, sure, the first I had ever met face to face. Cadet Undercandidate Eula Faggio was last to come out of the dodo, and he had looked neither angry nor happy. The guy, he was a male of his species, seemed to think the whole thing was a grand adventure. With the Ruha escorted away, and Smythe addressing the commandos, I invited Fangio to the Flying Dutchman's conference room. He gawked at everything along the way, to the point where I needed to drag him away from various things that he wanted to inspect. I assured him there would be plenty of time for him to get a tour of the ship later.
Colonel Bishop, I have never been inside a Theranin star's hip before.
Remembering when I had first stepped aboard the ship that became our Flying Dutchman, I could sympathize with him. Actually, because we had just captured the ship and I was afraid someone or something would take it away from us, I do not remember spending much time in sightseeing. What I remember is being anxious to the point of terror and hoping my new crew didn't see how scared I was. Damn, that was so long ago it felt like it had all happened to another person, not me. A whole lot of stuff had happened since then. We finally reached the conference room where he arranged two chairs so he could sort of sit down. That reminded me to ask Skippy if we could fabricate proper furniture for our unexpected guest. Also to ask what we needed to do about his other needs. Could a beetle use the showers in the ship's cabins, or did we need to modify one of those also? Cadet Fangio, I began. Cadet under candidate was too much of a mouthful to say every time. I am sorry about taking you away from your people, and I promise we will return you.
Do not be worried, Colonel Bishop. This is the most exciting thing that has ever happened to me. This is the only exciting thing that has ever happened to me.
My reply was an insightful and intelligent, score one for humans. I was surely making my species look good. Not.
My rank is under candidate cadet, because I have not yet been accepted as a cadet. I just recently completed initial flight evaluation and am, or was, waiting for an assignment to primary flight school. The reason I volunteered to fly with the alien Legion team was my father thought it would look good on my personnel file. Also, because I had nothing else to do while I waited for a flight school slot to open for me. No one else. He twisted his mandibles in what he might have been intended as a grin. Wanted the assignment.
Because it takes you away from home, I guessed. His antennas lifted. Was that surprise? Sarcasm? There was a Ruhar guide to body language of various species, and I read it a while ago. Now I wished I had studied it more recently.
No one else wanted to fly with humans, because most of my people were afraid your pilots would crash into an asteroid. Also, your species smells.
His mandibles twisted.
Interesting. No offense.
None taken. Hey, to us, Kristang smell like burnt toast or something like that. Without taking in a sniff to make it obvious, I breathed in slowly through my nose. Most of Cadet Fangio was covered in a flexible material similar to a Ruhar skin suit, so the only exposed parts of him were his head, which I guessed was his neck, and the claws of two forelimbs. There wasn't much of his leathery skin exposed to the air, and I had to concentrate. In the darkened bay, there had been a scorch smell, like burning plastic. That came from the hull of the Dodo. It was not unusual for dropships to emit an acrid smell when they came back to the ship, especially when they had plunged through an atmosphere or been baked by the local star. The Dodo had been operating in the system's asteroid belt, far from the star, so the scorches on its hull came from the radiation of the Flying Dutchman emerging from a jump wormhole right on top of the dropship. In the conference room, I had noticed some of that distinctive smell lingered, and I wondered if it had soaked into my hair and uniform while I was in the docking bay. Now I realized part of the smell was coming from Fangio. It actually was not unpleasant. There was a scent like paper left in the hot sun, and a combination of coconut oil and maybe nutmeg? I think. Really, it smelled like being at the beach and eating apple muffins. That's the best way I can describe it. That made me anxious about what I smelled like to him. He shuddered with a raspy, wheezing laugh that made the hair on my arms stand on end.
The stinkiest species I have ever encountered is the Bosphorak. Wee-hoo! Their stench is foul.
Smythe had told me what the Mooncrawler vehicle smelled like when his team had stolen one from the birds. Because I was aboard the Dutchman for that part of the moonbase mission, I had fortunately missed that delightful experience. Given Fangio a grin that I hoped he knew was friendly body language, I laughed. Anyway, I apologize for taking you away from flight school.
No need to apologize. You have already won a wager for me.
I did?
Yes. When the ghost ship attacks were first reported, actually.
His antennas dipped low over his eyes.
After the second attack, or maybe the third. After you hit the convoy.
That was our third attack, I told him, without needing to refer to the data on my laptop. Every one of those attacks was burned into my memory, not just because of the violent action, but because we practiced each action over and over in simulation, then ran what-if scenarios based on our after-action report to see what we could have done better. After that attack, I placed a prop bet. He stopped and looked at me. Do you need me to explain what a prop bet is? No. Shaking my head, I thought about my Uncle Edgar. He loved to play side bets during games, especially during a big event like the Super Bowl. A prop bet is about something other than the result of the game. Stuff like, will the AFC team score more or less than X points in the first half? Or how many TV commercials will be shown in the third quarter? You could place money on wagers like that without caring or even knowing who won the game. The idea of a prop bet was not unusual. What I didn't understand was what game the Beatle was talking about. What was this prop bet you made?
It was about whether the ghost ship was truly controlled by a rogue faction of the Bosphorok or some other force.
You bet on that? Wait. I had a sick feeling. You bet the humans were flying this ship? If the Giraptor was somehow speculating that filthy monkeys were involved in the unusual and unexplained events going on in... No. Fangio's antennas bobbed jerkily side to side in a gesture I remembered was their way of indicating humor.
I merely wagered that the official story of a rogue Bosphorok faction was not true. Many of my friends thought I was foolish to wager that the Max Hulks were wrong. They told me, the senior species have access to the best data and analysis. How could they be wrong?
Ha ha! He wheezed with laughter, and it sounded like a tin can caught in a blender. Keeping my instinct to cringe in check, I pressed him for information. None of your friends bet that humans were responsible?
No.
He found that question amusing.
Your people were not even on the list of options, as I remember. No one would...
He inhaled with a whistle.
Oh, if someone did wager on humans, he would clean up. He would be a legend. Oh, that lucky bastard!
It was such a relief that our secret was still safe that I missed whatever he said next. To cover, I grunted and nodded. And that would be a lucky bet, yeah.
Colonel,
he cocked his head at me, his antennas bent in a U-shape.
I asked how many Maxalt's ships have you destroyed?
Why? I tried to joke. Did you bet on that also? The earnest look on his face told me the subject was no joking matter. What, I asked, was the over-under?
15.
15? That surprised me. That low? Wait, you mean 15 after the third attack? Our tally at that point was only, 2 + 1 + 5, 8.
No, 15 total. Before the ghost ship is caught, destroy it, or just stops.
Stops?
You can't go on forever, can you? The Maxalks are throwing more ships into the fight, unless you have an unlimited source of spare parts.
He used his antenna to shrug, or that's what it looked like to me. We have spares, I said cautiously, not sure how much I wanted to tell him. Although what did it matter how much he knew? He wasn't going to tell anyone until it no longer mattered to us.
The wager on how many ships you destroy expires after 1 year. 1 year on our homeworld. That is about...
He closed his eyes, trying to remember trivial information.
15 months on Earth. Colonel, I ask because the Maxalts of course do not release accurate information about their losses. Their fleet is so powerful.
He shuddered slightly, his antennas twitching.
It's hard to believe any of their ships could be lost in battle. Have you destroyed more than 15 of their ships?
Before I answered, I wanted to know a little more about him. Did you bet on the over or the under?
Over. You destroyed more than 15 ships?
You might say that. I tried to be casual about it while humble bragging.
Current count is 42.
42?
Technically, a couple of the ships in my count had been self-destructed, but they still counted in the W column as far as I was concerned. The Kitty sure counted those ships as losses. Yeah, the Maxulk set a trap for us, but we ambushed them instead. I indulged in a bit of bragging on behalf of the merry band of pirates. They lost 14 of 20 ships in that one fight. We got away with minor damage. That was not exactly a lie, depending on the definition of minor. Valkyrie had been able to fly away from that battle, and the damage had since been repaired. Skippy assured that because of lessons he learned during that flight, our mighty battle cruiser was now even more powerful than before. He also warned me that we should not ever get into a fight like that again. I wholeheartedly agreed with him.
42, Fangio said quietly.
He whistled, or maybe that was another type of laugh.
Ah, Colonel Bishop, you have made me very happy. The smart money was on the under.
Ugh!
Tell me something. There were wagers on who is flying this ship and our win total. It didn't feel right to talk about war as a sporting event, but that's how the Beatles thought of it. Was anyone betting on how long we would continue attacking?
Yes.
He glanced away. Maybe he figured the subject wasn't something I wanted to hear.
The Central Wagering Office published odds on how long until the Maxolts killed or captured you.
He flashed what was supposed to be a smile.
Most of those bets have already expired, and you are still here. Most of the money went toward wagers on when your attacks would stop.
When we would give up, you mean?
When you would be unable to continue.
He tried not to offend me.
Or when you decided you had caused enough headaches to the...
My translator stumbled when I heard kitties. That made me wonder what nickname the Giraffe used for the Maxulks, and what they called us.
Colonel, my people hate the Maxulks. We were delighted to see that someone was giving them a bloody nosy.
As the Beatles did not have noses, the translator must have decided that was the best equivalent. We have temporarily paused our attacks, but that is a change in strategy.
What is your strategy, if I may ask?
It's... Again, I debated how much to tell him. Evolving. Then I realized that might be translated as we are making this shit up as we go. We are looking for targets of opportunity, I explained. Whatever is the best way we can disrupt the enemy's ability to support extended combat operations.
Against Earth, you mean?
The Beetle was not stupid.
Our intelligence reports that the Maxolts have already sent a battle group to your home world.
Leaning back in my chair, I indulged in a self-satisfied grin. Yeah, well, that battle group's return home will be delayed. Like, permanently.
Weak!
He whistled, a sound like rusty pieces of metal scraping together. Damn, no way was I ever going to invite a Beetle to karaoke night. Their singing must be horrible. He leaned forward on the conference table eagerly.
Is that battle group part of the 42 ships in your count?
No. The fate of that battle group trapped outside the galaxy was not something Fangio needed to know. But we did also destroy the first two ships they sent to Earth, so I think maybe our count is 44. He shook his head.
For the purpose of wagering. The count begins with the first ghost ship attack at Coprodru.
One of his antennas lifted halfway up.
Unless that was not the first ghost ship attack.
Ah, for the wager, your odds makers are probably limiting the action of Valkyrie. We didn't have Valkyrie back then. Those first two Maxulk ships were blown up by the Flying Dutchman. Both of his antennas stood straight up.
You attacked two Maxulk's cruisers with a Theranin star carrier? How is that possible?
It's a long story, Cadet. Maybe I'll tell you someday. Okay, so now I have to decide what to do with you. The sudden expression on his face told me what I said might not have been translated the way I intended. Waving my hands, palms open, I hastened to correct the mistake.
Hey, sorry. All I meant was which parts of the ship you will have access to.
Do you give me your word that you will not interfere with our operations? He seemed surprised that I even asked that question.
Colonel, you are fighting and winning against the ultimate enemy of my people. I believe we are on the same side in this war. In the absence of orders, I must do what I expect my leaders would want from me. I pledge to help you in any way that I can.
Cadet, that's great. Thank you. My decision was made easier by knowing that Nagatha or Skippy would be watching everything the young beetle did. He was young, not even a cadet yet. It bothered me that his parents would be worried sick about him until we could return him home. He would also be missing 2 years of flight school, which would put him behind his classmates and derail his career plans. Unless... Cadet, have you ever flown a Theranan dropship? In a simulator, I mean.
No. Why?
Because while you're with us, you might as well continue your studies. We can teach you to fly Kristang, Theranan, and Max Salk's spacecraft.
Yeah.
The poor guy was hyperventilating.
You would do this? For me?
For us. It would be useful when you return to your people for you to be able to compare the flight characteristics of various spacecraft. Most of your time would be in a simulator, and, well, we'll need to modify the controls. And the seats, I reminded myself. Probably I should have mentioned the idea to Skippy before I opened my big stupid mouth.
Colonel, he pointed a leathery claw at my chest. I see wings on your uniform. You are a pilot?
I am an army aviator, yes.
That is good.
Okay. I tapped the table and signaled for Frey to come into the room. She was still wearing a mech suit and had a rifle by her side, but her faceplate was open. Captain Frey here will show you to a cabin.
Colonel, may I make a request first?
Crap. If the beetle wanted time in a flight simulator right away, I was going to crush his hopes. What is it?
All of my gear, including my other clothing, is aboard the dropship. Could someone bring it to my cabin? I have a...
He ran a claw down his... sort of his chest or thorax or something.
Been living in this suit for several days. It is unpleasant.
Frey answered for me.
I'll take care of it, sir.
Chapter 31 Dinner that evening was late, as measured by ship time. According to the body clocks of the commando team, we had captured them just after their lunch, but that was late afternoon for us, so we waited until they were hungry. We also needed time to prepare something special to welcome our new teammates. While waiting for food to be served, I was answering uncomfortable questions and trying my best not to glare too hatefully at Lamar Green. The guy had to be wondering what he had done to get on my bad side. Enough questions had been asked about the mysterious AI that had been helping us that Skippy just couldn't stand it any longer.
Joe,
he hissed in my earpiece. The audience is demanding the main attraction. They are tired of the warm-up act. Cupping a hand over my mouth, I whispered back, I am not the warm-up band, you idiot.
Idiot? Me? An idiot? You are not a warm-up band. You are just a monkey making balloon animals until the audience rushes the stage and throws you out. This is a travesty.
Do not speak until I... His voice boomed over the speakers as the avatar appeared. Not just the avatar. He had added lighting effects and dramatic music to his grand entrance, which had all the understated class of a pro wrestling match.
Everyone, may I have your attention, please? Behold, 'tis I, the one, the only, the legend, his almighty awesomeness, Skippy!
The Magnificent.
Who?
Fabrone asked, confused, looking to Smythe for answers.
Ah, it's me, you tête de nœud.
Skippy made the insult in French. I knew from French Canadians that it meant something like knothead or knucklehead.
I am the AI who has been helping this troop of filthy monkeys. I am an elder AI.
He cleared his throat. That was your cue to be struck by unfathomable awe.
It would be appropriate at this time for you all to kneel before me and contemplate how unworthy you are. Fabron was unimpressed. With a very Gallic shrug, he turned to Smythe. Your AI is an asshole, no?
He is an arsehole, for sure, Smythe agreed, his shoulders shaking as he tried not to laugh.
Hey! Skippy screeched. You monkeys really are not going to worship me?
That pissed me off. What do you think? I gave him an entirely justified single-finger salute.
Duh. Duh to you, he retorted.
Now I was really mad.
Duh! Duh! Duh!
I made an L with one hand and placed it against my forehead. Commandant Fabron shifted his feet uncomfortably.
We are doomed, he groaned.
Because of this? Smythe scoffed. No, this is typical. They'll get over it.
You saved the world more than once. With those two?
The French soldier was incredulous.
We saved the world because of those two.
You are serious?
Believe me. Smythe rolled his eyes. I wish it weren't true.
It took a full 10 minutes to get Skippy calmed down, and even that required an assist from Nagatha. It did not help that, shockingly, the new people decided they liked Nagatha, and that Skippy was an arrogant asshole. When Skippy launched into reciting his top 10 list of awesome things he had done, I had to put a stop to it. Besides, steaks were grilling in the galley, and we didn't have much luxury food left. No way was I going to miss a prime meal because of Skippy's shenanigans.
Okay, Skippy, can I make a deal with you?
Hmph!
His avatar had its arms crossed defiantly.
Like what?
Send your top 10 list to everyone's Z-phones and we will all vote on which one is the most awesome.
Ugh! Ignorant monkeys are going to judge my actions?
Or we could just ignore you, I suggested.
Let's go with the voting thing, he said quickly. But,
oh crap, what is it now?
Everyone has to submit a 5,000-word essay on why they voted for a particular awesomeness, including what about me made it so unfathomably awesome.
Can we compromise? And instead of a 5,000-word essay, people include whatever emoji best represents your awesomeness?
Okay, but nobody can use the poop emoji, he insisted.
That blew my plan out of the water, but I agreed.
Deal.
Sir.
Smythe paused in the doorway to my office. He was there for our regular morning meeting, which usually lasted only 5 or 10 minutes. The meetings were short because he always was anxious to get back to something more important.
Smythe, come in, sit down, I gestured, distracted by my laptop.
On the screen were a variety of objects I was considering as a wedding present for Sims and Frank Muller. Candlesticks were an obvious choice. Too obvious. When Skippy saw me browsing what he called girly stuff, he asked why. Then he suggested that instead of me waiting until we got back to Earth, I find something he could create with the ship's fabricators. It would be a present from the two of us, which would save me the trouble of shopping and him the embarrassment of probably choosing an inappropriate gift. Working with Skippy on the gift sounded like a good idea until he shot down all my very good suggestions. Either the ship's fabricators could not manufacture the item without pulling them away from the vital work of making parts for our ships, or my suggestions were, as Skippy tried to say tactfully, lame. At that point, we were back to the drawing board. What I wanted to do was give them something practical, because they would hopefully be living on the undeveloped world of Avalon, or some other equally primitive beta site. My best suggestion, to give them a dropship, ran into several snags. Neither Sims nor Muller were pilots, and Sims certainly didn't have time to take flying lessons. Plus, I didn't actually own any dropships. They were technically all UNEV property. And there was the issue that we might need them to evacuate Earth. Skippy had drawn up plans to build space elevators on Earth to replace the one the Theranin had rented to the White Wind Clan. With 2 or 3 space elevators running, the process of bringing people and supplies into orbit would go much faster. Except that, Skippy annoyingly reminded me, building space elevators would consume time and resources that could better be used elsewhere, like possibly constructing another starship.
Whoa!
Before you get too excited, he meant an unarmed transport ship, something like the Yuki-Shan. A tin can with a jump drive that we could stuff full of filthy monkeys. He thought there might be enough of what he called go-fast parts left over from our Lego project that he could use to cobble together the engineering section of a ship. All humanity had to do was build the front section, which was still impossible given Earth's level of industrial development. Anyway, what was I talking about? Oh yeah, wedding presents. The good news was that I already knew about the engagement, which Sims was keeping quiet. That gave me a head start on thinking of a gift. Smythe sat down, and his body language told me whatever he wanted to talk about, I wasn't going to like it. He got right to it. We need to discuss Gunnery Sergeant Adams. We do, or you do? Both. It wasn't often that I could make him uncomfortable. Her fitness for duty, you mean? She's on your team, it's your call. Not completely, sir. Shit. He really was uncomfortable with the subject. My special regard for Adams was no secret among the crew. I should never have put Smythe in a position to worry that he might offend my feelings. Look, Smythe, I'm serious. I held up my hands. It's your call. Well, you and Dr. Skippy. I don't want to be involved. I need to not be involved, you understand? I can't play favorites. That's not fair to the crew, and it's especially unfair to Adams. If you clear her for duty and that puts her life back on the line, that's what she wants. Smythe did not need to be concerned about Adams. He needed to be concerned about me. I needed to be concerned about me. How would I react if Adams was in another life-and-death situation where I had to choose between saving her and achieving the mission? What would I do? I knew exactly what I would do, because I had begun considering the problem the day that Adams left the sick bay and returned to her own cabin. She was recovering, and that meant she might return to duty. What would I do in that situation? Easy. If I couldn't handle the pressure, I would surrender command to Sims and let her make the decisions. It's not a subject we had discussed, it was sort of understood. If she thought I was cracking under pressure, Sims wouldn't wait for me. She was a damned good XO, and she knew what the ship and crew needed. The look of relief on Smythe's face told me I had hit the mark. In that case, sir, I am not clearing her for duty. Oh, shit. I had been all wrong about the source of his anxiety. He wasn't worried that I would refuse to let her put herself in danger. He was worried about her reaction and my reaction when he declared she wasn't ready. Or worse, that she would never again be ready. That was an important distinction. Yet, you mean? You're not clearing her for duty yet? Adams has made remarkable progress, both physically and in cognitive skills. Given time, I am confident she can rejoin the stars. Her recovery has focused on regaining basic motor skills. She has not been training with the team, nor do I believe she can safely train with the team at this time. Does she know? That drew a wry laugh. Our gunnery sergeant is the best judge of her own abilities. She is certainly aware of her level of progress. Okay. It was my turn for relief that made my shoulders shudder involuntarily. You will talk with her? Yes. I wanted to assure her there will be a role for her during the rescue. Oh, hell yes. We can always use people on the bridge. I'll get Sims to assign Adams to a weapons station. She'll like that. Training to serve on the bridge will divert time away from her preparing to requalify for the star team, he cautioned. She can suck it up, I replied. And to my surprise, realized that is how I really felt. She wanted me to treat her no different from anyone of the crew, and that's exactly what I wanted to do. I'll talk with her about that. If you want my advice, sir, I suggest you have Sims tell her. Because I'll make it too personal? No, because that is the procedure for any other member of the crew. He arched an eyebrow and waited for my reply. True. Good idea. Is that all? I know you want to get back to training with the new people. Training is what I want to discuss next. The rescue operation will be conducted on the surface of a planet. It would be useful if we could train in similar conditions. Oh, hey, I'd like that too. Flying all the way back to Avalon takes too much time. Plus, the last thing I wanted was to go back to that world until we had opened a wormhole to Earth. Do you have a candidate planet in mind? No, sir. I was hoping you and Skippy could think of something. I got nothing, I admitted. To be useful for training, we needed a planet with roughly the same gravity, atmosphere, and surface conditions as the target site. Plus, most importantly, it had to be uninhabited and unlikely to have visitors. That was a tough set of conditions. Skippy? What is it now? His avatar groaned. Don't pretend you weren't listening. I wagged a finger at him. What can you do for us? Do for you? Joe, there are plenty of worlds out there you could use for training, but like the real estate saying goes, it's all about location. Any place with easy access is inhabited, or might have ships stopping by for surveys, monitoring, or their own training. Okay, fine. What about places that do not have easy access? Like what? Sometimes Skippy could be dense as a monkey. Like, we have the unique advantage of being able to create new wormhole connections. Back when we first talked about a beta site, you looked for candidates inside the galaxy. Yes? He was making an effort to be patient with me. And we discarded all those sites. None of them were useful as a beta site. None of them were useful because you thought the next wormhole shift, or the one after that, would give alien bad guys easy access. But right now, we don't care about what happens during the next wormhole shift 100 years from now. We just need a place for training. Oh. Well, why didn't you say that? He glared and shook a finger at me. There is a place within 2 wormhole transitions that would be an excellent site for training, and for the all-important rest and recreation this crew needs so very much. Hey! We can call this resort Club Skippy! It is very exclusive, Joe, and the rates are quite reasonable. We get a free vacation before we buy a timeshare, right? I asked, and Smythe snorted at my joke. I will show you the brochure, Skippy gushed. Afterward, there will be a short 4-hour presentation with light refreshments while I tell you all about the amazing benefits of fractional ownership in Club Skippy. Smythe was already halfway out of his chair. I'll leave you to handle the executive decision, sir. Coward, I muttered. I'll take this one for the team, Smythe, but I am voluntolding you to sit through the next karaoke night. When Adams was told she was not cleared for duty with the star team, that she wasn't even cleared to train with them, and that she was assigned to sitting at a console on the bridge, she left us. That sucked. Well, I don't mean she left the Merry Band of Pirates. She left Valkyrie to go aboard the Flying Dutchman. She wasn't mad at me. She wasn't upset with anyone. She was disappointed, sure, but only a little. She knew she wasn't up to speed yet, and hadn't really expected to accompany Smythe on the rescue. Her going aboard the Dutchman was not an act of anger or defiance. It was simply practical. It wasn't even her idea. Sims assigned her to the other ship. Executive officers handle routine personnel matters, leaving the captain free to focus on important captain things like getting to the next level on Super Mario Kart. My first notice that Adams was no longer aboard was a line in a morning status report. Like I said, it was simple. Adams had worked a bridge console aboard the old Dutchman, so she would need only quick refresher training to get signed off as ready to pull a duty shift. Getting familiar with the very different controls and environment aboard Valkyrie would have taken her so long, the rescue op would be over before she knew what she was doing. See? Simple and practical. I was still a little pissed that Sims hadn't told me ahead of time. Then I got pissed at myself for being unfair. My instructions to Sims were to treat Adams like any other member of the crew, and that's what she did. A person aboard the Dutchman was scheduled to come aboard Valkyrie for training, so Sims used Adams to backfill that position. We did that all the time, cross-training people on the different systems of our 2 ships. It did hurt that Adams had not given me a goodbye note or stopped by my office before she went aboard the transfer dropship. That left me very confused. Was she avoiding me and subtly telling me that what happened between us was only her damaged brain and the nanobots talking? Or was she afraid of making the situation awkward? Was I reading too much into the situation? Crap, it was eating away at me. I needed to know. To talk in private, I went to my cabin where I could close the door. Skippy, I have kind of a delicate matter to discuss with you. No jokes, please, okay? Dude, why so serious? It's about Margaret. Oh, gotcha. She's fine, Joe. Right now, she is... I know she's fine now. My question is about something that happened back when she was recovering. She is still recovering. You know what I mean. back when alien machines in her head were doing part of the thinking for her, when she didn't feel like she was herself. Okay. There was a cautious tone in his voice. Go on. We had kind of a moment, you know? Me and Margaret. She called me Joe instead of Sir or Colonel. She said that she was okay with me leaving her behind for the good of the mission. Hell, she was proud I did that. What is your question, Joe? I need to know, was that her talking? She hasn't called me Joe since that day, and uh-oh, no can do, sorry. You can't do what? Doctor-patient confidentiality. I can't talk about her medical condition now or then, unless you claim this affects her fitness for duty, which we both know is bullshit. This affects my fitness for duty. I think regulations state you need to discuss that with Sims, he suggested. Screw regulations. Nope. You can't play that game with me. I made a promise to Margaret that I would not divulge any details about her condition to anyone. Dude, you should have asked me back before you surrendered the power of attorney she gave you. You can't even give me a freaking hint. Here's a hint. Ask her. No way. She doesn't seem to want to talk about it. I'm not 100% certain she even remembers it. The last thing she needs right now is me dumping my emotional baggage on her. Not now. After the rescue, maybe. No, that's not right. After we get the wormhole open near Earth. No, crap. Then we'll be at Earth and they'll be pulling her off the ship for debriefing. They'll pull me off the ship and throw me in prison. Dude, your life consists of jumping from the frying pan into the fire. I know it. This sucks. Looking around my cabin, I sought something I could smash. What I decided was that destroying some object would only be a form of self-destructiveness. Thank you. Is this some weird empathy thing? You're thanking me for listening to you? No, I'm thanking you for keeping your promise to Margaret. Oh, no problem. I do care about her, Joe. Me too, Skippy. Me too. Club Skippy was actually a pretty nice place. It was a rather ordinary world with the benefits of being isolated, and humans could breathe the air and didn't need to wear special protective gear. There were mountains and rivers and trees and wide-open grasslands, and the local predators weren't anything to worry about. We identified two areas that had similar terrain as the islands where the prisoners were being held on Rikers and set up mock structures based on Skippy's best intel about those camps. That intel might be out of date, and the Star Team knew they had to be flexible. In addition to practicing the rescue, we used Club Skippy to sharpen our overall fitness. Running on a treadmill is just not the same as running over broken ground and up and down hills. We did a lot of that, and by we, I mean I ran with the stars and participated in as much of their training as I could. The Paradise people actually had an advantage over us, because they had recently been training on a Ruha world with gravity 9% heavier than Earth normal. We usually kept artificial gravity aboard both ships at 1G. That was heavier than the Dutchman was designed for, and lighter than the previous setting aboard Valkyrie. Yes, I know that heavy and light are not the technically correct terms. Those describe what gravity does to objects that have mass. Heavy and light are how normal people think about it, so that's how I'm describing it. The gravity aboard Valkyrie was actually variable in sections of the ship, especially in the areas the Star Team used for training. They exercised and practiced maneuvers in gravity that was anywhere from 60% below to 22% above Earth normal. Training at different levels of gravity had multiple purposes. To accurately replicate conditions the stars might encounter on a mission away from the ship. To assist in conditioning. And if you haven't tried to run in gravity 20% heavier than you used to, believe me, it is a tough workout. Finally, and maybe most importantly, it forced people to relearn their eye-hand and eye-foot coordination. In the Star Team training area aboard our mighty battlecruiser was a bulkhead lined with basketball hoops. They weren't used for pickup games. Smythe was too concerned about his people getting injured to allow unstructured sports. No, the hoops were there to show people what happened when the force of gravity changed. Pick up a basketball that feels heavier than normal. No problem, right? You just put more force into your throw. No, it doesn't work that way. When you throw, Your brain is subconsciously calculating where to aim based on how the ball would fly in Earth-normal gravity. In a different gravity field, the arc the ball follows is different, either higher or flatter than you're used to. A grenade tossed in anything other than a standard 1G also won't fly the way you expect. Bullets also follow a ballistic arc, unless they are powered rounds. Anyway, your body, deep down to your muscle memory, needs to relearn how to throw things, how your feet rise and fall, how to run and jump and shoot, depending on the effect of local gravity. Before a star team leaves the ship, they hold a weight that is the same mass as a standard grenade, memorizing how that mass feels in their hands. Sure, mech suits and rifle sights automatically compensate for differing levels of gravity, but our best weapon is a well-trained person. Without the person, the weapons are useless. I said the Paradise people had an advantage over us because they had been training, living, resting, and sleeping in higher gravity for more than 4 months. The planet where we practiced for and revised our plans for the rescue had gravity only 2% higher than what we experienced aboard our ships. We barely noticed the extra 2%. Well, that's my story and I'm sticking to it. Where we noticed was while running together. The Paradise people ran just a bit more easily, reached the top of hills faster, and were less out of breath than we were. Of course, no one cared if someone else was a bit... No, that was total bullshit. Special operators hate being second at anything. Kapoor urged our people on, exhorting them until he too was gasping for breath. Smythe could have run faster than anyone on his bionic legs. He didn't. He ran back and forth, speeding up to catch the Paradise team, dropping back to match our slower pace. The commandos did not miss a chance to rub it in, pausing at the top of hills to drink from their water bottles while they waited for us. That seriously annoyed me. No, it pissed me off. Part of what pissed me off was seeing Gunnery Sergeant Lamar freaking Green charging up hills faster than I could run. He didn't say anything. He didn't even especially look at me. And that really pissed me off. It was like he didn't consider me to be competition and... Okay, I'm not being fair to the guy. If he and Adams had resumed their relationship or hooked up or whatever, I didn't know about it because it wasn't any of my business. Green was stationed aboard Valkyrie, and Adams was assigned to the Dutchman. Maybe, as part of the daily status report, I might have checked on who flew between ships for R&R, and didn't see either of their names. Adams was busy refreshing her skills in the Dutchman's CIC, and Green had a lot of catching up to do with learning how to use our equipment and adjusting to our tactics. They simply didn't have time for personal relationships, and that wasn't anything I did. That didn't mean I couldn't be happy about it, though as the commander I should not have been happy about it. Hey, I never claimed to be perfect. Chapter 32. Our third morning on Club Skippy, I was running with the stars, and I was proud to say that I wasn't bringing up the rear. On the run up our last hill that morning, the commandos surged ahead as usual, leaving us dragging behind. I strode to the front of our column, pumping my arms and keeping my chin up. Right behind me, the stars probably thought I was pushing it too hard, too early. Frey matched my pace, striding beside me and whispering through gasps.
Sir, you're gonna crash and burn.
I'm okay, was all I could manage while increasing my pace. She dropped behind slightly, while ahead, the Paradise team had already stopped at the top, standing or jogging in place as they waited. The last 30 meters I eased up, sucking in great breaths as the stars drew even with me. My goal had not been to race to the top. What I wanted was to not be too out of breath when I got there. As the Paradise team began turning to run down the hill, smirking at us with their smirky little smirk faces, I shouted, "Hey, if you guys got into shape, you wouldn't need to stop all the time." They didn't know how to respond to that. Standing there with their mouths open, sputtering words we couldn't hear. We raced right past them, blocking the narrow route down the other side of the hill. By unspoken consent, that descent turned into a race, down the hill, splashing across a stream, and an all-out sprint across a field back to our camp. To my delight, the group was mixed as we crossed the imaginary finish line, and there was much genuinely good-natured trash talk and backslapping as we recovered. Smythe winked at me, and over the course of the day, all the stars gave me silent thumbs up or fist pump gestures. The best comment I got was from Frey.
"I thought you were crazy, eh?" she said. "You are, but in a good way, sir."
The old man, who wasn't old, still had it. I also had a twisted ankle from stumbling over a rock, but Dr. Skippy's patented magical nanobots fixed me right up. Even if the nanobots working inside my leg made me go temporarily numb in, let's just say, an adjacent area. Of course, Dr. Skippy hadn't warned me about that side effect. In my tent that afternoon, Skippy was explaining the basics of his infiltration plan for the rescue operation on Rikers. I was only sort of half listening. "The dropships will need to be careful of their heat signatures once they descend over water. Without..." "Wait," I jerked my head up. "Why is heat a problem?"
"Ugh.
Were you not listening to me at all?"
"Obviously I was listening. I heard you say something about heat signatures.
Duh," I added to cover up the fact that I had not been listening.
"Oh, for... what is the question? Do you not understand?"
"I do understand about infrared signatures. Why is it a problem? Both of the islands where prisoners are being held are in the tropical zone. One of the islands was in the planet's northern hemisphere, the other south of the equator. For simplicity, we referred to the islands as Objective Dixie and Objective Yankee. Both islands were not merely dots in the vast ocean. They were each about the size of Hispaniola, the Caribbean island that was home to Haiti and the Dominican Republic. According to Skippy, the islands had been chosen by the White Wind Clan because they were far from the mainland where almost all the lizards lived, plus the islands had enough land and rainfall to support humans growing almost all of their food. Separating the prisoners between two islands was a way to ensure the entire population was not lost if disease spread among one group. "We will be descending over water to avoid detection," he explained patiently. "The ships going to Objective Yankee will be flying over warm water all the way, so heat signatures are not a problem. But the ships going to Dixie will be approaching from the direction of Riker's South Pole, where the water is cold this time of year. Let me explain this to you, Joe. It will blow your little monkey mind." A line appeared on the floor. "Imagine, this is the planet's equator. On this side..." Skippy was suddenly wearing shorts, a Hawaiian shirt, and a straw hat. Plus, he was holding... was that a margarita? "It is summer." He stepped across the line, and he was then dressed in a parka, and he was standing on a snowboard. "On this side, it is winter." "Summer?" He was on the summer side. "Winter." He jumped back to his snowboard outfit. If that wasn't annoying enough, he began hopping rapidly across the line, chanting, "Summer, winter, summer, winter, summer, winter." "Okay, I get it." I waved my hands in surrender. "It's kind of cool when you think about it," he beamed with happiness in his Hawaiian shirt. "No, it's cool to never think about it. I'm sorry I asked." "Hey, it's winter in the southern hemisphere, so is it chilly at Objective Dixie?" "No. I covered that in the briefing this morning. You were not listening."
No way could I argue my way out of that. "You're right. I was distracted." Closing my laptop, I turned my chair toward him. "You have my complete attention, please. Start over."
"Huh?"
"Please, you can give me a pop quiz at the end to test if I was listening. If you fail, will you watch season one of The $6 Million Man?" Shit. There was more than one season of that show? I panicked. "How about I watch one episode, and you can pick the crappiest episode of all seasons?"
"Deal."
He cheated. The pop quiz was about obscure facts he vaguely mentioned but were included in the footnotes of the briefing I was supposed to read. I was reading it, but the damned thing was 800 pages. Also, the assault team really did not need to know nerdy trivia about how the planet's magnetic field had flipped in the ancient past. Anyway, I failed the quiz, so I was forced to watch an episode of what fans call SMDM. Again, Skippy cheated. Instead of having to suffer through one TV episode, which would have been about 42 minutes long, he dredged up a made-for-TV movie called Bionic Ever After. Mercifully, this 96-minute crapfest was so bad, it killed the franchise. So we have to be thankful for that. Since I had not seen any previous episodes, I was totally lost in the plot. You know how, when you are waiting for a file to download so you can do some super important thing, you kill some time on social media? You click on one link, that leads to another, then another, and soon you realize the file download timed out, and anyway, the project was due 3 hours ago. Anyway, after watching the Bionic movie, I got curious about who was responsible for that crime against humanity. Okay, so I skimmed through an episode, then another. You question whether those shows were as bad as I say? I have two words for you. Actually, the show shortened it to one word. Fembot. Google it. Go ahead, I can wait. See? Fembots. Because I do not hate you, I will not summarize the plot of Bionic Ever After. Hey, you in the back. Yeah, you know who I'm talking about. You. I do hate you, and you know why. Don't argue with me. We both know I'm right. You are banished until you watch every minute of that crappy 70s TV show, plus the Bionic Woman spinoff. Skippy will be giving you a pop quiz, so you'd better take notes.
Hey, Joe,
Skippy announced over my Z-phone earpiece. I have news for you. His avatar was floating above my cot. The accommodations at Club Skippy were not exactly the five-star resort promised in the glossy brochure he had printed, and Skippy had backpedaled on his promises of a luxury experience. After we landed, he changed marketing strategy, boasting that it was an eco-resort. That explained why we were sleeping in tents and cooking food over wood fires. Actually, everyone enjoyed the change of pace from the sterile environment aboard the ships. Hey, I appreciate the fancy towel animal you left on my cot yesterday. That was a very nice feature of Club Skippy. What? You know, I teased him. The towel was all twisted into something. Was that an octopus or some sort of snake? Dude, I have no idea what you're talking about. You hung the towel from the hoop holding up your tent after you took a bath in the river. It must have fallen onto your cot. Huh. I guess that explains why it was wet. So, what's up? How can you have news? We're in the middle of nowhere. True, I guess it is not technically news, but there is no expression for olds, so you know what I mean. Anyway, I was bored, so I dug deeper into the data we pulled from that relay station we pinged before we took the wormhole shortcut to get here. When I say deeper, I mean way down to the bottom of the barrel. It appears that the Kristang have gotten more serious about information security. Either the Civil War has motivated them, or some of them suddenly woke up to the risks. I stared at him. Better infosec? Like, tougher encryption? That wouldn't matter to you, right? Your awesomeness can crack any code. Pretty much, yes. Although there is a difference between encryption and codes that I will not waste my time trying to explain to you. The problem is, this is actually quite clever of the lizards. Who'd have thunk it, huh? They used one of their more sophisticated encryption schemes to secure a series of video files. When I reviewed the files, I saw they were boring stuff about clan politics, plans for attacks in their civil war, blah blah blah. Nothing I or any of us care about. But, because I am so bored while you monkeys play games down there, I recently took another look at the videos. My intent was to alter them, maybe cause some mischief. While taking the video apart, I discovered a second, much higher-level encryption embedded in the files. The lizards must have purchased that encryption from a species like the Bosphorok. Well, I cracked it, of course, no problem there. Those sneaky damned lizards must have anticipated someone would read their files, so they made the content so dull no one would look deeper. They fooled me, Joe, I'm sorry. This is embarrassing. I learned an important lesson for sure. Oh, crap, is this bad news? Not necessarily. It depends on how you look at it. Sighing with anticipation that my day was about to be ruined, I sat on the couch. Okay, hit me with it.
Well, we have a complication.
You know I hate complications. You hate them. Hey, I wanted a nice simple deal where you helped me contact the Collective, then I could bail on you filthy monkeys in the middle of nowhere. But no, I've been stuck out here for freaking years helping you morons lurch from one crisis to another. Complications. Ugh. You're the one who decided you need more info before you try contacting the Collective again. Well, sure, but One of those years was us stuck in the Roach Motel because you had to go poking around in a canister you knew could be dangerous.
Well.
And what's this shit about you planning to bail on us in the middle of nowhere?
Why must you dwell on the past, Joe?
He sighed. Fine. What's the complication you're going to ruin my day with now?
It's not just a complication. It might also be the answer to a problem.
Okay. Sitting on the cot, I dared to hope for a tiny nugget of good news.
Like what?
You have been trying to dream up a cover story to explain why anyone other than us would go through the effort of rescuing our people off Rikers.
Skippy had said our people. That was interesting. I mentally filed that fact away to think about later.
Right. So?
So I might know of another group who wants those people alive.
Yeah, the Theranin. We know that. It doesn't help us.
I mean another group who are not Theranin. A rival Kristang clan, Joe.
Oh, crap. Are we going to get in the middle of Lizard clan politics again?
Damn it! Why would a rival clan...
This would go faster if you let me explain.
Please enlighten me, oh great one.
The Kristang Council of Clans...
The what?
It's a semi-formal committee that mediates disputes between clans to obtain an appropriate resolution and consults on issues that affect all clans.
They mediate disputes, but this council couldn't stop a civil war?
The council handles minor issues, Joe. Besides, war is the appropriate resolution for major disputes, according to the Kristang. Will you let me explain this complication?
Sorry.
He sniffed, indignant. The Council of Clans stepped in because negotiations with the Theranin could affect all clans.
Ah, the Fire Dragon clan invited this council to help negotiate a deal?
The Fire Dragons very much did not invite the council to stick their noses into private clan business. The other clans demanded the council act now, because they are all worried the Fire Dragons will get some special sweetheart deal with their patrons and screw everyone else.
The Fire Dragons are at war with most other clans. Why would they care what this council thinks about anything?
Two reasons, Joe. The Theranin are required, by treaty and by long-standing tradition, to treat all sides of a civil war equally. The little green pinheads can't take sides or favor one clan over another. Like, they can't refuse to transport the warships of a particular clan, unless the Council of Clans decrees that one clan or another has behaved in a manner detrimental to Kristang society overall. In that case, the Theranin are required to punish the offending clan. In this case, the Fire Dragons.
Then this is good news. These council idiots will drag out the negotiations, giving us more time to conduct the rescue.
That is true, Joe, except for the complication I mentioned.
Crap. You haven't told me the complication yet?
Nope. The complication is that at least two clans aren't waiting for the council to act. They each separately plan to hit Rikers, capture the humans, and force the Theranin to deal directly with them instead of the Fire Dragons.
What the...
Why? Then the council would make the Theranin punish them.
Because there are rules, and then there is the enforcement of rules.
The Theranin have been known to bend the rules against playing favorites. They can't charge different shipping rates to one clan, but their star carriers can be temporarily unavailable due to maintenance issues. Or they might be slow to reach a destination. The council can grumble about that, but they can't directly do anything. The clans planning to snatch the humans off Rikers are betting the rewards outweigh the risks if they can negotiate their own sweetheart deal with the Theranin. Plus, a raid on Rikers would be a daring action that all the other clans would admire, whatever they say about it publicly. There is also another factor. Burying my face in my hands, I mumbled, "Of course there is." All the major clans learned a valuable lesson from the Alien Legion fight on Fresno. Many of them want to keep the humans instead of selling them to the Theranin. The next time the Legion lands on a planet, the Kristang want to use the human children as hostages against UNEV.
Shit! I hate those lizard MFers.
They are much hated across the galaxy, even within the Maxalts Coalition.
How much time do we have?
Wait. To hit Rikers, the lizards need to get there first. Why would the Theranin fly them there if the lizards are acting against their patrons? And hey, the lizards would need a ride back home after they capture the humans.
It's simple, Joe. The lizards are not getting a ride from the Theranin. They have hired Bosphorok star carriers for the job.
The Bos? How the hell can the Birdbrains be capable of helping anyone? They are getting their asses kicked by the kiddies. They are available to the lizards because they are getting their asses kicked, Joe. The Bosphorak are playing the long game. They assume at some point the Maxalts will have punished them enough, or get bored and go home. The birds will then be weakened, and as you know, they are more worried about their supposed allies, the Theranin, than they are about the Gerapta. If the Gerapta push too hard and capture too much of the birds' territory, the Maxalts will intervene. But if the Theranin take advantage of Bosphorak weakness and take over vital star systems, supposedly for the good of the Coalition, the kitties might not care too much. So the Bosphorak are okay with the Alien Legion posing a threat within Theranin territory. Supporting a raid on Rikers accomplishes two goals. It will prolong the Kristang Civil War and might ensure the Alien Legion continues to cause problems for the Theranin. Both of those developments weaken the Theranin at a time with the Bosphorak are weak. Shit. Plus, with the Maxalts striking all over Bosphorak territory, being away from home is the safest place for their star carriers. They offer discounted rates to the lizards. Ah, damn it. Trying to keep track of the freaking politics in this war drives me crazy. Joe, the politics of this war makes Game of Thrones look like children playing a game of Go Fish. Pretty much everyone is trying to stab everyone else in the back. Or they would engage in backstabbing if they thought the reward was worth the risk. Yeah, I know. Never sign on to the Maxalts Coalition. Oh, it's not just them, Joe. The Rindaloo are relatively benign overlords, more like benign neglect due to their extreme laziness, but they are still overlords. They subtly suppress their clients' efforts to climb the technology ladder. If the Gerapta had an opportunity to break away, they might take it. Ha! My laugh was bitter. I wonder what odds the Beatles would give for success in that effort. Okay, what does this mean for us? When are those clans going to hit Rikers? The first could arrive within 9 days, Joe. 9 days? Holy shit. Even if the raid fails, the Fire Dragons will put our people under heavy security. We'd never pull them out alive. That isn't the real problem, Joe. Kristang operational security is notoriously poor. What we really need to worry about is the Fire Dragons hearing about the plot in advance of the raid. A subclan of the Raiders could rat out its major clan to the Fire Dragons in exchange for a favorable position when the Civil War is over. Actually, the Fire Dragons might already be increasing security around the humans because of the Council's scrutiny of the matter. Great. I threw up my hands. Just freaking great. Once, just once, I'd like to get a break, you know? We would all like a break, Joe. The entire galaxy is sick of this endless war. Even the Maxalt's leaders know their own population has grown weary of the war. That is why the rotten kitties have their clients doing most of the fighting, and their clients are really sick of the fighting. This is a war without winners. A war that can't have a winner. Yeah, sorry, I know. Okay, what info do you have about these raids? Only that three clans... Three? You said you didn't let me finish, numbskull. Three clans were considering an operation to seize the humans on Rikers, and two of those clans have put their plans into motion. The third clan recently suffered the defection of a subclan, so they are distracted at the moment. The messages I intercepted had almost no details other than the departure dates of the raiding forces. When I said the first raid could happen in 9 days, that is my estimate, based on how quickly a Bosphorak star carrier could travel to Rikers. Wonderful. Travel time from here to that star system is 4 days? 4 days, assuming I screw with wormholes to create shortcuts. Well, duh. Why would we not want to use shortcuts? Because if someone noticed odd wormhole behavior along a line pointing toward Rikers, they might wonder why and start asking uncomfortable questions. Duh. Shit, that duh is on me. And please keep reminding me when I'm an idiot. I know that is all the time, I added before he could hit me with an insult. How long without shortcuts? 12 days. Damn it, that's no good. All right, give me options that include some shortcuts to get us there in 6 days. Connect me with Sims, please. Sir? It sounded like she just woke up. Sorry, Sims. I cringed. I asked Skippy to connect me with you. I should have asked for the duty officer. I'm awake now, she said with less irritation than I would have under the circumstances. Okay, we're bugging out. Soon as possible. I'll notify Smythe. Skippy will explain why. Ask him for the short version. There was a sound like her feet slapping the floor of her cabin. I always ask for the short version. Erasing signs of our presence down there will take... We don't have time for that. All the mock structures we built in Hajistan, they can stay. By the time the next wormhole shift gives the bad guys access to this planet, it won't matter. Skippy has one of the reactors offline for maintenance, she reminded me. That won't affect our departure. Looking around my messy tent with dismay, I contemplated just jamming everything into duffel bags and sorting it out later. Understood, Sims. Bishop out. Instead of asking Skippy to connect me, I just hit the speed dial on my Z-phone for Smythe.
Sir?
Whatever he was doing, he was out of breath.
Smythe, change of plans. Get everyone to RTB right now. We're leaving as soon as we can get the essentials packed up. Leave the training sites as is. We don't have time to erase our tracks.
Trouble, sir? He asked, as my phone pinged to announce the general recall notice he just sent out.
The trouble is on Rikers. We need to move up the rescue. We're going in 6 days.
6? He was shocked.
The Star Team had only been practicing the rescue operation at the mock camp for 2 days, and the practices had revealed serious problems with our original plans. Today was a stand-down to revise plans and conduct a walkthrough before tomorrow's practice session.
We will make it work, sir, he assured me. There wasn't much else he could do, or we would have to cancel the entire rescue. Somehow we had to make it work.
I'm as unhappy about this as you are. I know this is a rush job, and we're not fully prepared.
But that isn't the major problem, sir. Today is Thursday.
Yeah, so?
If we go then, we will be launching the rescue operation on a Tuesday.
Ah, shit, I groaned. Let's hope this is not a typical Tuesday for the merry band of pirates, huh?
I would not want to wager with our Giraptha friend about that, sir.
Yeah, I took a deep breath.
Me neither.
Chapter 33
Our Ruhag guest was still pissed off and uncooperative. That was too bad, because Sims and I made a real effort to make her comfortable and talk with her. The problem was, if she suddenly changed her attitude, I would suspect it was all an act, so we couldn't trust her. The commandos were not all happy with the situation either. They had spent enough time with our pirates that the people from Paradise knew the whole unhappy story, that we had as many failures as successes. Most importantly, they knew Earth was doomed in the long run. Not even in the long run. Hearing that was tough for the commandos. While stranded on Paradise, they had feared the worst about Earth, but at least they could hope. Hope that by some miracle humanity's homeworld was safe in its isolation. Now they didn't even have that faint hope. A miracle had happened, and Earth was still doomed. Commandant Fabron assured me his people would focus on their jobs, but sooner or later reality was going to sink in, and morale would take a serious hit. The only person who was actually happy to have been shanghaied was the Giraptha. He was young enough that the whole experience was a grand adventure to him. What he most wanted was to stay with us until we returned to Earth. I visited him in the galley while we were in flight toward Rikers. Partly I wanted to see how he was doing, and partly I found the beetles to be fascinating. Sims and a couple other people were in the galley, but the Giraptha was sitting by himself, engrossed in whatever he was doing. A glass of water and discarded foil packs of ration bars littered the table. I was glad to see he was eating the bland food Skippy had fabricated for him.
Hello, Cadet Fangio, I greeted him. What are you doing there?
Fangio invited me to sit at his table, gesturing excitedly at the laptop we had loaned to him. It was filled with sports statistics.
Colonel Bishop, Skippy has provided me with important information. I must thank you very much. Your human sports are fascinating.
Yeah, what's so interesting about... I looked closer at the laptop. You looking at NFL drafts going back to 1982? Why?
Our most sophisticated AIs attempted to rerun college drafts of your American National Football League, based only on information that was available at the time, he explained. The